Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that is as content to eat popcorn and watch cars explode on screen as it is to delve into cinema that explores the very mysteries of existence. We did a little bit of both last week, as first we sat through the latest James Bond film, No Time to Die, which features the fifth and final appearance by Daniel Craig. Then, just for a change of pace, we took in Lamb, a film by Icelandic writer-director Valdimar Johansson that takes the family film into a totally unexpected direction. Let's begin this week's show by exploring the 21st century version of a character dreamed up way back in 1953. That character, of course, is James Bond, the suave British agent dreamed up by Ian Fleming, who carries the 007 designation, which means he has a license to kill. Daniel Craig is the sixth actor to play Bond, if you don't count David Niven in the 1967 parody Casino Royale, and he is one of the most popular. This is his final appearance, and director Cary Joji Fukunaga has him follow a team-written script that in many ways is the typical 007 adventure. At first, Bond feels betrayed by Madeleine Swann, played by Léa Seydoux, the first woman he's loved since the death of Vesper Lynd, who was played by Eva Green in the more authentic 2006 version of Casino Royale. What Bond doesn't find out until 5 years later is that Swann has a long-held connection with the megamaniacal Lucifer Safin, played by Rami Malek. And it is only while trying to figure out why a mission to Cuba has gone so horribly wrong that Bond once again finds himself forced to meet up with Swann and deal with his suppressed emotions while trying ultimately to keep the villainous Safin from destroying the world. What else? For a film series that has gone back and forth from humor to seriousness, No Time to Die shows signs of growth in theme, at least. For one thing, the women, while still easy on the eyes, are far more than sex objects, yet director Fukunaga still gives us plenty of excellently staged action, which is, after such a long time being away from the big screen, what those of us who are Bond fans have been longing for.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see where the franchise goes from here.
No kidding.
Because this is the final chapter in the Daniel Craig era, if you will, that started with Casino Royale. And frankly, I don't think ever got better than Casino Royale. I still think that's the best of the Craig Bonds. And one of the best Bonds, period, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And this is maybe the first Bond movie that we've seen that feels like a final chapter. I mean, Craig himself has said, I am done with this. So, yeah, I'll be curious to see where they go next, because this particular run of five films has really changed the Bond movie model, because they've been, especially the last three, have been almost serialized, where plots from one movie carry over into the next and characters carry over beyond, you know, the basic stable of characters that, you know, Q and Moneypenny. I mean, they're here too, but there's more continuity between these movies than I feel like there has been in the past, which I think is more in keeping with the Fleming novels. And as in keeping with the novels, these movies, the Craig movies, that is, are much more focused on death and regret and heartbreak, and there's ghosts from his past that keep haunting him, and a lot of the campy kind of self-aware humor that was very present in, say, the Roger Moore era and even the Pierce Brosnan era, which is what I grew up on, is mostly absent here, even though you have some script contributions by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who I think brings a lot of quips and self-deprecating humor to No Time to Die. I mostly like this movie, I think. I mean, it's really, really long. This is the longest Bond movie. I think it's like 160 minutes, and it feels like it's 160 minutes.
And then if you see it at the AMC, you also have the pleasure of sitting through 25 minutes of trailers.
Yes, because that's always a treat.
I think that some people would have used the good brains that God gave them and shortened the trailers.
Then you could possibly play the movie one more time during the day.
Right,
but no,
exactly.
They got to sell. I understand. So I want to kind of talk about the problems I had with the movie, and then maybe we can talk about some of the good stuff, because there is good stuff in No Time to Die. But the last hour of this movie, I think, is really uneven. Most of it is Bond running around this giant concrete lair, and all of the rooms kind of look alike, and he keeps coming back to the same room, and it just kind of felt like it was all variations on the same theme. You also have the actress Lashana Lynch, who's playing the new 007, because Bond had retired at the end of Spectre, and now she has taken over, and they kind of have to team up. I thought her character was not really given that much to do. And same with Naomi Harris as Moneypenny. I mean, you mentioned, Dan, in your intro that the women are more than just sex objects, but they also don't get that much to do in this movie either. So it'd be interesting to see if they change that going on. And then perhaps the biggest sin of all is Rami Malek as the villain. He shows up in the opening of this movie. It's a flashback. And I thought, this villain's going to be great because he's scary looking. He has this creepy mask. He has a history with the Lea Seydoux character. And then he just kind of vanishes for about 90 minutes and then comes back at the end. And I didn't think was imposing at all. I don't know if that's because of how Rami Malek chose to play that character or if there just wasn't any writing being done on that front. So a mixed bag in the last half, but I was mostly positive about the first half of the movie, and maybe we can talk about sort of the action set pieces that happen then, because I think there are some really, truly extraordinary ones that happen in this mixed bag of a final Daniel Craig Bond movie.
I would agree with your unevenness comment, because it was sort of up and down. And I have no problem with the action films sort of taking breaks between the action, because one, it would be too expensive for them to have that opening sequence repeated over and over and over and over. But it also gives us a little breathing room and time and so forth. One of the sequences that I liked the best, honestly, was the one that involved Paloma.
Yeah, played by Ana de Armas.
Yeah, agreed. Because James Bond is like looking at her because this is a Cuba sequence.
3 weeks of training,
right.
She says.
And she says, yeah, you know, and he's like, oh my goodness, what have I gotten into?
Yeah, she's sort of starry-eyed.
She sort of undersold her skill set, I believe. And so I actually thought that was one of the most fun aspects of the film.
And I don't know which credited writer wrote which parts, but that character really felt like a Phoebe Waller-Bridge creation. So I don't know if she influence the way that character was written, but it did have the comedic sensibility that we expect from.
I want to jump in here because, first of all, I didn't think the movie was too long at all. I thought for a movie that's 2 hours and 46 minutes long, I thought it worked all the way through. It kept me interested. I was fine with that. And I didn't have any problems with the last hour. I didn't have any problems with Rami Malek. In fact, I thought he was a nice counterpoint to what Javier Bardem did in, what was it,
Skyfall.
Spectre Skyfall, right, exactly, in which I thought he overplayed the bad guy. They both could learn something from Christoph Waltz, who he has like 37 seconds here as Ernst Blofeld, who has more venom in simply reading the phone book than most actors do.
Which is why it's disappointing that they used Christoph Waltz the way they did in this series, which is not nearly enough.
Yeah, and I also want to say that first opening is appropriately creepy. That's the one where we meet Madeline and we meet Safin.
It's almost like a horror
but
movie.
But then after that, that sequence that takes place in Matera, Italy, a place that Mary Pat and I have been to, is, I swear, it was 10 minutes of pure action. Yeah. A lot of it is covered you see it in the trailers, but you don't get near the effect it's just an amazing sequence.
When you and Dan were there, did you ride a motorcycle up steps and jump them off ledges?
Of course we did. Yeah. I mean, and Matera has been the scene of other movies, most notably The Passion of the Christ that was filmed by Mel Gibson there. But you really did not even have a sense of how narrow and how twisty those streets are, because these little saucy are built into the hillside. And yeah, it's a very picturesque and a perfect place. I mean, so we went from there, we saw the Amalfi Coast, we went to Cuba, we were in Norway.
Santiago de Cuba, where this movie is also takes place. It probably was not filmed there, but.
Right. So I think there was much to like about this. I liked the Jeffrey Wright character, so I would have appreciated his being more part of this. And Lea Seydoux, I really like her, and I don't know if this was the ideal showcase for her. That's just my feeling, but maybe my thoughts about her are always going to be colored by Blue is the Warmest Color, a film that she has.
Where she shows everything.
Simultaneously has loved and lamented her part.
Right. Well, and it's funny because this entire string of films has sort of been defined by Bond's relationship with two women, with Vesper Lynd and Judi Dench's M, both of whom have died since they were introduced. And then they bring in Lea Seydoux, who came in during Spectre, I think is when we met her. And she's supposed to be the next great love. But I never really bought the fire or intensity between the two of them. I mean, she and Daniel Craig are both attractive people, but beyond that,
there's
not
much
there. Yeah,
I agree. There wasn't a whole lot
of
chemistry.
Well, but the movie uses that because she says, nothing's going to happen here until you forget Vesper.
Right,
and
right.
Yeah, I suppose so.
At any rate, before we go, real quickly, favorite James Bond? Mine is Sean Connery. Mary Pat?
I guess I'm going to have to go with Sean also.
Okay, if I didn't have to pick Sean Connery, I'd probably go with Craig.
Yes,
I
agree.
I think he brings a totally different vibe to the character than anyone else did.
Absolutely. And that was our discussion of No Time to Die, the new James Bond film. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcast of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Lamb. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
We say this often because it's an important fact about public radio. Everything you count on from us. Trusted news, in-depth features, conversations, music, and culture depends on your support. In moments of challenge, possibility, and progress, public radio is a sound, trusted source of information. And that means your participation is more necessary and powerful than ever. Please help SPR meet these momentous times with your generous support so we can be there for you today and for generations to come. It's easy and secure. Just click the red donate bar at SpokanePublicRadio.org, fill out a brief form, and emerge a new member. You'll be glad you did whenever you turn on your radio. And thanks.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the latest James Bond film, No Time to Die. Let's now move to the Icelandic dip into myth-making titled Lamb. Maria Noomi Rapace and Ingvar Hilmir Snær Gudnason live on an isolated sheep farm at the base of a fog-shrouded mountain range. Their life seems mundane, consisting of the day-to-day farm activities, until one day, unaccountably, the birth of a lamb changes everything. To give away more would spoil the surprising, some might say shocking, plot twist that rests at the heart of this film by Icelandic director Valdimar Johansson. Working from a script that he co-wrote with the Icelandic writer and poet known simply as Sjón, Johansson explores Iceland's traditional ties to the mysteries of nature and, in a sense, offers up a storyline that can be seen as a warning to humans who interfere in the very ways of that nature. Much of Lamb progresses at a snail's pace, even if the production values, not to mention the acting, especially by the Swedish-born Icelandic Reyes Rapace, are first rate. But when it comes time for Johansson to wrap things up, he works quickly, if mind-bendingly enough, which isn't surprising for a movie that at the 2021 Cannes Film Festival won an award for, what else, originality.
And it definitely deserves that award, I think. Not that it's completely writing on a blank slate, because I think we've seen some other adaptations of this theme. But I think the way that this film is paced is probably what I was most astounded by. And that's a pretty strong statement, considering what happens during the film. But I think if you've spent any time traveling in Iceland, you do, at the beginning of this film, get this sense of how isolated these people are living. But still, with all modern conveniences, in this absolutely stunning setting, raising these rams and lambs in a way that seems to be satisfying to them, they appear to have a good relationship, the husband and wife, but we feel as though there's this specter hanging over everything that's happening. And so at some point we discover sort of what the issue is.
40 minutes in, I looked at my watch.
That they've experienced a loss and now they are yearning to replace that void or that vacuum in their lives. But I appreciated seeing this on the big screen just because of the landscape and the vantage points and so forth. So there's this dynamic between the husband and wife, and then all of a sudden this other person sort of shows up inexplicably, and we discover that that's the husband's brother. We also learn that he was a rock musician or a pop musician of sorts, and we get the sense that there's a history between him and Maria, the wife. And so he simultaneously wants to hang out with the two of them. But then when this new presence enters their lives in the form of this baby lamb with unique features who's born, then things start to get a little more complicated. And I thought actually one of the most poignant parts of this film happens to be the fact that Maria and Ingvar take this lamb into the home. And then the mama lamb is like standing outside and she is just bleeding and, you know, she's keening and she was giving them, I think somebody characterized it as the equivalent of major animal stink eye because she wants that baby back and they're not inclined to give it to her.
Especially so, Maria. Yeah.
Of course, there's going to be only one way to deal with the demise of mama lamb. So there's this surreal quality. It supposedly has a folklorish connection, although I think most of the Icelandic folklore that I'm familiar with has to do with elves and, you know, what...
Boy, this movie could have used some elves.
Interfere. Yeah, could have definitely used some elves. So I don't know. I think in the end, is there some food for thought here? Sure, but not enough to sort of carry this through, at least to my way of thinking.
Yeah, I mean, Lamb is extremely well made, as you said. I want to call it the cinematography by Eli Aronson, which is moody and foggy and beautiful. And it's extremely well acted. And it's also, I'm sorry to say, extremely stupid. I did not buy this movie at all. And I want to talk about the true auteur of this film. And that's the distributor, A24, who we have talked about a lot. A24 has made some of my favorite movies of the last decade. And they have done such a good job branding themselves, particularly within the indie horror space. And they know how to pick films because they're not making a lot of movies. They're mostly picking them up at festivals and distributing them with their logo front and center. And they're really good at picking films that align with their aesthetic. And I have a feeling a lot of movies now are being made with that aesthetic in mind because filmmakers want A24 to pick up their movies. And this is another film, Lamb is, by A24 or being distributed by A24, that is being advertised as a horror film. And I think a lot of people are going into this expecting, say, Hereditary, which is a horror film that A24 distributed, or Midsommar.
Or The Conjuring, or Midsommar, yeah.
Yeah, which is another A24 film. And
as
you mentioned,
there are elements of horror.
Yes, I think there are elements of folk horror for sure, of body horror,
folk tale horror.
Yeah, yeah. But this is mostly a pastoral drama, and I think that's my problem is that the movie never really reconciles what it wants to be, and it's very straight faced, and yet it has this central image, the titular lamb, which we have decided off mic not to spoil what that central image is, what makes it special and interesting, that I just couldn't get around. I mean, every time it showed up on screen, I was laughing, and I couldn't tell if the filmmaker wanted me to laugh at it or if I was supposed to think it was some visual representation of all the big themes that you mentioned in your intro. So I felt like this could have been an evocative 20 or 30 minute short, particularly with the lack of dialogue that's going on in this movie. There are long passages where people don't say anything, which I don't have a problem with.
There was a handball game in the middle.
Oh, well, that's great. but I felt like this was a short film that had been extended to feature length. I don't know if this needed to be 110 minutes. And when the ending comes, because, again, you're waiting for some kind of shocking ending, and you get one, I just thought it was so ridiculous that I wish the whole movie had been about that final character, if you want to call it a character that shows up. I thought, I kind of wished it was about this the whole time instead of these boring Icelandic people on this farm.
I have to be quite honest. When the lights went down and the curtain went up, so to speak, I sat there and went, what the hell was that? But in thinking about it more, I did come to some thoughts about nature and humans and everything. I think they tend to get lost for a lot of different reasons. But the thing I do come back to is that what I appreciate about Lamb, among all the things that you've mentioned, Nathan and Mary Pat, is that whole notion of originality. The movie never went where I thought it was going to go. The brother comes in, and as you say, Mary Pat, there's some sort of relationship there, and you think, oh, I know what's going to happen here, and it doesn't happen. Consequently, I was always wondering where it was going to go. Did I necessarily like where it finally went? No, but there's so much about Lamb that is to like, I can't completely just dismiss it.
Well, and I did like seeing Noomi Rapace in this particular role because
she's good.
I mean, I like her in any role.
Yeah, we came to know her initially through her turn as Elizabeth Salander.
She was the creator of that role.
Yeah,
yes.
The girl and with the dragon tattoo, et cetera, et cetera. And so I thought she did play her part in a way that I found her to be experiencing this believable grief. It seemed like she and her husband had a genuine connection. I thought that the whole course of dealing that she had with her brother-in-law seemed realistic. It's just the relationship that she had with Lamb that's a little puzzling, but hey.
A little puzzling. Yeah, no, I agree with everything you say about the aesthetic aspects of the film. I mean, it is impeccably put together. And I think this filmmaker, who this is his first feature, I think he's got a lot of potential. And I also think that this is one of those movies that might really connect with you if you're on its wavelength, if you happen to relate to some of its imagery or some of its allegorical trappings in ways that I couldn't relate to.
Just don't go into it thinking it's a horror movie.
Yeah. I mean, there are horrific things within it, but calling it a horror movie is too simplistic. So maybe I wanted it to be more of a horror movie. That maybe that was my problem.
Yeah.
I wanted this to be more like The Witch with that killer goat in it.
And that was Lamb, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbender, Murray Pat Truthart, and I discussed the James Bond spy flick, No Time to Die. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarbrick for both producing and engineering the show. We thank you, too, our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words written by the writer Richard Wright in his novel Native Son. In a movie, he could dream without effort. All he had to do was lean back in a seat and keep his eyes open. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.